From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On the program today, we talked to a researcher who studied a roadside drug test device.
It's a good device because the alternative is we don't have one.
But there are concerns beyond that. A symphonic concert for victims of sexual abuse. We'll talk to the composer who counts himself among the survivors.
Well, primarily this symphony is aimed at the survivors themselves.
We talked to our political commentators about Governor Gretchen Whitmer's order to determine what's a safe level of PFAS chemicals in drinking water.
The current standards are only recommended standards and not enforceable standards.
And we talked with a photographer about his days in the White House.
President Ford really gave me the keys to the chicken coop. I mean, I was like the photo fox of the Ford administration.
All that, plus why is there a big milk surplus right now? Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A bill signed by former Governor Rick Snyder in the last couple of days of his administration says Michigan cannot have stricter regulations than those set by the federal government. However, Governor Whitmer is having Michigan set its own PFAS standards. Our Friday political commentators weigh in on that later in the hour. But first, there's a new photo exhibit at the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Museum in Grand Rapids. President Ford's personal White House photographer, David Hume Kennerly, selected the photos, many of them never exhibited before. Mr. Kennerly joins us now. I saw a small sampling of the photos in the exhibition, and they were amazing moments and images. You've created what you call a close-up portrait of President Ford's humanity. How do you capture that in a photo exhibit?
Well, I think it's a sum total. There are about 100 photographs in the exhibition. And when you walk through it, you see Richard Nixon leaving and then President Ford being sworn in. And you follow this trail right through when he loses the election to Jimmy Carter, and that's the end of his presidency. I think his character and integrity comes out in the photographs. Against the backdrop of today, he was honest and he was a man who was steady at the wheel. All that comes through. You can't read somebody's mind in a photo, obviously, but I think it paid off in terms of the humanity of Gerald Ford and the compassion of Gerald Ford, the kind of people who were around him. It's all there.
President Nixon was not always open to the White House photographer taking photos. In fact, he shut him down a lot. How much access did you have with President Ford?
President Ford really gave me the keys to the chicken coop. I mean, I was like the photo fox of the Ford administration. He let me photograph everything all the time, every classified meeting. There really wasn't anything that I missed. And the best part of it was, it was like I wasn't there. I was part of the woodwork. And he didn't look at me twice when I was in the room. It was just expected I would be there. Nobody said anything about me being there, certainly not him. He never waved me off from I don't like the way this looks. It was a fairly extraordinary circumstance in its own right, having a photographer do that kind of work in that situation.
Now, you had daily contact with him all day long, probably more than his closest aides. What was your personal relationship to President Ford like?
Well, I was very close to President Ford and the rest of the family. Our relationship was good. A lot of people have said it was like a father-son relationship. I didn't feel that. He already had four kids. But I really was brought in a way, as an adjunct member of the family, I guess. But it was a very warm and natural relationship where I had huge respect for him, and he just let me do what I did. And that was the best part of it.
President Ford was only one of the world leaders you shot. One of the striking photos I saw in the exhibit is of Soviet Premier Brezhnev. Were foreign dignitaries open to the White House photographer sticking around? I mean, you could catch them in some pretty awkward moments, I imagine.
Well, one of the great pluses of that job was having access to Brezhnev, Deng Xiaoping, Pope Paul VI, all these different people you would normally never get close to. I didn't recall having a problem with any of that. Normally, if I was in a meeting with those leaders, I would spend some time and then go out because a lot of them didn't want to not that I felt, you know, bad vibes, but it seemed like a diplomatic thing to do. And so I had plenty of time to get the pictures I wanted to get, and then I would normally wait till the meeting was over or go in toward the end. But just to get close to them was enough. Like, some of the portraits I got of Brezhnev are, like, mind-boggling.
You didn't have the advantage of immediately seeing the image you took like the people do with digital cameras. As you were taking photos, did you generally know when you had a keeper, an iconic shot, or did you discover them looking at the contact prints?
Well, usually you have to wait till they come back from the lab. There were many times I really hoped I got the shot that I ended up getting, and sometimes I didn't. I mean, it could be as simple as somebody's blinking in the middle of a good moment or something else that would destroy the photo. But I had a pretty good idea. I mean, we are all about capturing the moments, and I think that's one of my strong suits. And I had a lot of mentors. I mean, you'd call them mentors today. Well, not literally, but people who I followed their work. Yōichi Okamoto, who was LBJ's White House photographer, was really the gold standard of presidential photography to this day. And he was the first civilian to do it. Ollie Atkins with Nixon was the second, and I was the third. We go all the way through today. Donald Trump has a photographer, Shayla Craighead. The role and the access depends totally on your relationship with the president of the United States.
I was watching a documentary on Pete Souza, who was Reagan and Obama's. You know, he's kind of out there. He's, you know, got some political thoughts, and he's not afraid to express them. But I got to thinking, you guys are members of a pretty elite club. Are you friendly with the other presidential photographers?
Very friendly. Pete and I are good friends. We go back to the Reagan days. He was also a newspaper photographer, worked for the Chicago Tribune. Yeah, and there aren't that many. I mean, I'm the senior statesman, I guess, of the group. Statesman's probably overstating the case. But those of us who are left as the chiefs, me, Michael Evans, who was Reagan's chief photographer, was died. David Valdez is still around, and he was George Bush 41's photographer. Bob McNeely and Sharon Farmer were with Bill Clinton. Eric Draper with George W. Bush, and, of course, Pete Souza with Barack Obama. That's it. You're right. It's a small group, and I would say we all get along pretty well, and I love looking at other people's pictures and how they did it.
I read that the most requested photo of yours is one of the president petting his golden retriever, Liberty. Why do you think that's a favorite?
I actually didn't know that that was the most requested photo. But I understand that. It's just a nice, quiet moment in the Oval Office, and it shows the President of the United States and the dog, and I could see why that might be one.
What moments did you capture that you feel are the most telling about who Gerald Ford was?
Well, one in particular was when he was in the middle of the Mayaguez crisis, which was a ship that was captured by the Khmer Rouge, and this is right after the end of the Vietnam War. There were 75 or 6 American crewmen on board. They captured them off the coast of Cambodia, and President Ford had to oversee getting them released, which meant a military operation. And that was the photo that the New York Times ran in their op-ed section after he died with something that I wrote about him. And I felt that moment was when he really had assumed the presidency in his own right. It wasn't just looking to Henry Kissinger for advice, even though he would take it. But I felt he really came into the presidency 100% during that crisis. And the picture with his glasses on his head and showing his resolve was a very powerful moment for me. And that was the photo I chose for the New York Times after he died.
There's an amusing photo of Mrs. Ford in the cabinet room. Would you describe it and tell us how that photo came about?
Yes. The picture of Mrs. Ford in the cabinet room was one of the great all-time moments. You'll never see anything like it again, is my guess, and there wasn't anything before. But on January 19th, the day before they were leaving the White House after Carter was going to be sworn in the next day, we were walking around. She was saying goodbye to White House staffers in the West Wing, and we walked by the cabinet room, which was empty, and she looked in there and had this mischievous glint in her eye, and she said, "I've always wanted to dance on the cabinet room table." And a couple Secret Service guys who were with us and a couple staffers thought she was joking, but I didn't. And she was a former Martha Graham dancer, and she was very athletic, really. And she kicked her shoes off and jumped up on the cabinet table and struck a pose. I took the picture, and it was really a moment for the ages. And I think she did it because that was the male domain up until that point. Very few women had sat around that table. And I think she just planted the feminist flag right there in the middle of the cabinet room. And the picture speaks for itself. It's actually one of my favorite pictures of all time because it's about her personality.
What was the last photo you took of President Ford?
The last time I saw him, it was in Washington, D.C., and it was his last appearance at a board meeting, I believe, of the Ford board. I think that was the last time. It's a good question. I'm not 100% sure. I would see them occasionally. I'd go out and visit them in the desert, so actually might be then.
Well, I got to tell you, as a presidential history buff and a hobbyist photographer, this has been a real thrill for me, a real honor talking to you, and I'm looking forward to seeing the exhibit at Ford Museum.
Well, the exhibit, they tell me it may be up through the end of the year. It had to be pushed for over 6 weeks, maybe even 2 months because of the government shutdown, which is probably not a bad thing because I hear the weather around here was pretty grim in January and February.
We had a polar vortex come through, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. I'd never even heard of that. We don't get those in Santa Monica, so you have my sympathy.
David Hume Kennerly was President Gerald Ford's personal White House photographer. The exhibit is called Extraordinary Circumstances. Mr. Kennerly's photos are on exhibit at the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Museum in Grand Rapids, and apparently through the year. That'll be great. Thanks very much for talking with me.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Coming up, a symphonic concert dedicated to survivors of sexual abuse. We'll talk to the composer who counts himself among them. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. You've probably heard that trade disputes and tariffs implemented by the Trump administration are hurting farmers. A U.S. government program is offering $12 billion in assistance to farmers. It's also instituting a program to buy surplus milk and send it to food banks. That's led to a distribution problem and a glut of milk for food banks in much of the nation. Unlike most of the other states, the United Dairy Industry of Michigan already had a relationship with food banks around the state called Milk Means More. It's been around for 6 years. Joining us now is Courtney Freeland. She's the Nutrition Outreach Manager of Milk Means More. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us how your program works.
So we've been partnering with Michigan's food banks for a while now. And it's really positioned Michigan's food banks with us and additional partners to be ready for this milk. It's been a growing process. It started out back with a partnership between Kroger and our organization and the food banks called Pour It Forward. And this was really the first time that we were bringing fresh milk into Michigan. And since that first milk drive, it has spread. And as it's spread and grown, Michigan's food banks have been finding ways to move more milk. And that looks different for every food bank, but with the help of strong partnerships across the state, we've been doing it, and we've been doing it so well that this influx of milk was a welcome attribute for the state of Michigan and the food banks here.
How does that compare to what's happening in other states?
You know, I don't know exactly the challenges that they're facing. There are challenges, right? It's a fresh product. It has a shelf life. It has to get distributed. That means it has to go from point A to point B. And so if you haven't figured out how that works and what works best for each part of the state, that can be a challenge. And that's been something that over the last 5 years that our food banks have been really working hard with Food Bank Council of Michigan and other partner organizations to figure out find a model and make it happen.
I understand your distribution network is more than just delivering milk to brick-and-mortar food pantries.
It is. So one of the great ways that Michigan's food banks have found success is through mobile pantries. So most of our food banks have mobile pantries that go out into the community. Maybe it's once a month. Maybe it's more than that. And they have found that this is a really great way to get milk as part of those distributions. So I know, for instance, in the Metro Detroit area, Gleaners Community Food Bank has a refrigerated truck that visits their mobile pantries as assigned to distribute that milk, and then it moves on to the next one. And it's a really great way to move milk quickly and efficiently.
I understand the federal government and some other states are looking at Milk Means More as a model. Do you know of anybody else who's implementing it?
We are one of 18 state and regions that operate like us, working on behalf of Michigan's dairy farmers across the nation. And so we are always in conversations with our peers as to what we're doing here in Michigan. I have a phone call scheduled tomorrow with a peer down in Florida. And then on top of that, the food banks, they're working across their network. So all of Michigan's food banks belong to Feeding America. And that network, they're constantly sharing across that. So the best practices that we're putting in place here, whether that's partnering with a grocery store to do a milk drive, or whether that's leveraging resources to put coolers into food pantries, or whether that's the school mobile pantry program, we're trying to share those wherever we can to get the word out about, here's what works for us. Maybe you can take a nugget of that and make it work for you.
If you're living in some of the Southwest states, you know, there's not a large dairy industry there. Most of their milk is imported from other states. And I'm wondering, if you don't have a large dairy industry like Michigan does to set up a program like this, how would you do it?
So I think that's a lot where the partnerships come in. All these states do have strong dairy partnerships. So even if their milk is coming in, they have resources, they have groups and organizations that partner together to help them to leverage what they do have. One of the things that I've heard early on in my relationship with Food Bank Council of Michigan and all of the food banks is, you've seen one food bank, you've seen one food bank. You've seen one food pantry, you've seen one food pantry. They're all so different and unique in serving their unique communities. So all we can do is share what we've done and share the resources and tools and partners that we've brought together and the food banks have brought together, and help them to figure out how they can connect their dots.
I only have one more question. How much additional milk are we getting now for food banks and food pantries?
Yeah, so I pulled some numbers here. Since last October, Michigan food banks have moved over 79,000 cases of USDA fresh milk. That's over 350,000 gallons. And that's just the USDA milk. This doesn't include milk that food banks have been purchasing. So we have a lot of food banks who have purchase programs. And we have an additional 216,000 gallons that are coming this spring into early summer. So there's a lot of milk moving. And we have additional partnerships who are always donating milk, or this doesn't include retail rescue or any of those types of programs. This is just the milk that is coming through that USDA program and has really positioned Michigan to be able to move it to the people that need it.
Courtney Freeland is the Nutrition Outreach Manager of the United Dairy Industry of Michigan, and the program is called Milk Means More. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
A symphony concert is being held this Sunday at Central Michigan University. It's being described as an evening of healing and reflection about the support people can give those affected by sexual assault. Now, if you're thinking of Michigan State's struggles with handling sexual assault, you're not alone. The composer of the two pieces to be performed is also thinking about those girls and women who survived that abuse. Here's a sample of the music. Evan Ware is the composer, and he joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much, Lester.
So before we start talking about the underlying motivation for your works, how do you describe your music to someone who's never heard it?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. It's very difficult, even to an expert, to give a very kind of accurate description of what it is that you do, because in contemporary classical music, everyone has kind of gone on in their own directions, and I would say over the past 50 years. And so it tends to be extremely personal. The best thing I can probably describe to you is what my influences are, and that says something about what you might hear out of my music. So my influences would be like the symphonies of Jean Sibelius, the Finnish composer, also the symphonies of Gustav Mahler, the Austrian composer, but I'm also heavily influenced by jazz, Miles Davis, Gil Evans, and I would say Bill Evans too, in terms of harmonic language and kind of textural density. So, you know, I like music that's maybe a little bit rich and that kind of moves between more familiar tonal areas, so tonality like, you know, E flat major or F major or something like that, and less familiar areas that you might hear in arrangements by people like Nelson Riddle or by composers like Claude Debussy or Yannis Xenakis, or, you know, like really kind of dense materials. And I use these to create the drama in the music.
I saw in a release that your music was described as angular, bristling energy, and that you frequently use it to confront alienation and trauma. How accurate is that?
I would say that's very accurate, because trauma has been a central part of my life. I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse that happened between the ages of 8 and 10. And I think, you know, before I was able to articulate that problem in my own life, which only happened when I was about 27, you know, my spirit, my soul was searching for ways to deal with the pain that I was going through. And so my music often uses a lot of repetition. So, you know, listeners who might be familiar with minimalism, like Steve Reich or Philip Glass, would hear certain similarities in my own music. And that repetition is often thought of as a kind of way of dealing with trauma, sort of repeating the same thing over and over again, working things out in gradual, slow processes over long periods of time. And that's kind of how I addressed my own issues and my own hurt, you know, try and peel it back like an onion until I came to a greater understanding of it.
The first symphony, which I listened to online, is titled The Quietest of Whispers, and as you said, it was inspired by your own experiences. You were also quoted as saying you started to realize that this symphony could be a means to help other men, quote, engage with their pasts in a way other than through rage, sadly the only deep emotion afforded men in our culture, end quote. How does The Quietest of Whispers address that?
I think one of the key events in my life was realizing that it wasn't in trying to be strong that I was going to be liberated from the pain of my past, but in fact, it was in being vulnerable and in allowing in the feelings of pain, hurt, betrayal, fear, all of those things, and integrating them into the story of my life. Because most survivors go through something called dissociation, where they kind of split apart the elements of their lives so that they don't take it all in at once as this, you know, terrifying story of abuse. And the work, at least the therapeutic work that I've done, has been to kind of reconnect all of the elements of my life into a whole narrative. I think, you know, men particularly are taught that we gain power by having power over other people, not by coming to know ourselves and coming to accept ourselves. And I wanted to provide a different discourse. I wanted to have a different conversation about this and tell people out there that, you know, it's okay to not be strong sometimes. And in fact, not being strong, and I mean, I use that in the typical sense, because I think it takes a lot of strength to be able to be vulnerable. But not being strong is, in fact, the keys to liberation in most cases.
You, like so many of us, were horrified by what happened at Michigan State, and for that matter, what happens at a lot of schools. You were quoted as saying the number of victims was as staggering as the depth of their betrayal, not only by the perpetrator himself, but by the university administration, faculty, and in some cases even family members. What does this symphony evoke that will help people be more mindful and supportive of victims of sexual abuse?
Well, primarily this symphony is aimed at the survivors themselves, and I think of the symphony as kind of a passage through the night that sort of settles in after the clamor of justice has moved on to other topics. So I think it's great that the perpetrator was convicted and that he will not see the light of day forever. And I'm satisfied with that. But I think that the difficult part, and certainly in my own life, the difficult part was to deal with the quiet that comes afterwards and the feelings of isolation and loneliness and, you know, being really separated from people around you because you've been through this experience that in many ways isn't very describable to people who haven't gone through it. And so this symphony is an attempt to build community through music, which is, I think, one of the great powers that music has. So what I wanted to do is to invite people to be vulnerable, to create a safe space in which they can be vulnerable and know that they're surrounded by a community that cares for them and that supports them and that will protect them through this passage so that they can find their own liberation. So the first vocal movement of the symphony, because there's a singer in this one, the first symphony doesn't have a singer. The first poem, great poem by Jane Hirschfield, it's called Da Capo, the poem. And the last line, you know, there's this kind of recipe that goes through the middle of the poem, which was actually extremely hard to set in music, but a very fun challenge. And you're sort of thinking, like, where is this going? And then at the end of the recipe, the poet says, eat, you may do this, begin again the story of your life. So I felt that this symphony could be an invitation to do that, to engage with the pain, integrate it into your lives, and know that you're doing so in a safe communal environment with people who support you.
So Symphony Number 2 complements The Quietest of Whispers. They're linked.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, on more ways than just in terms of concept, the first vocal movement, which I call Begin Again, begins on the exact final chord of the first symphony. So I took the same chord at the end of the first symphony and put it at the beginning of the first vocal movement of the second. And the second symphony, it exists in the same musical world as the first symphony for about the first four movements. And then in the fifth movement, there's this train horn. It's called Crossing. And what I did is I used some railroad crossing bells in the percussion section. Then I ripped a video from YouTube with the trains that go through Mount Pleasant, and I put it through an overtone analyzer so I could figure out what pitches were being represented. And then I orchestrated those pitches to sound exactly like the train as much as possible. And then as it passes your perspective, there's the Doppler shift and it drops a minor third. And what that does is that opens onto a new musical space that you haven't heard at all in the symphony or even in the previous symphony. And that's this kind of opening into a new world of possibilities.
Who will be performing the pieces?
The pieces will be performed by the group Apex Contemporary Performance, and particularly the Apex Sinfonietta, which is a group dedicated to new music, particularly music that is not heard very often. It's going to be conducted by Kevin Fitzgerald, who is the man who conducted the first performance of The Quietest of Whispers back in 2014. And so it's a real pleasure to be able to work with him again, because he's a very profound musician, the kind of person who could spend time with my scores and then come in with an analysis of what I was doing. And then I have to be like, wow, dude, get out of my head. it's pretty impressive. And he's just a fantastic musician, and he's gotten together a group of fantastic musicians that I think are going to do some really, really great work with this music.
You mentioned there was vocals in Symphony Number 2. Who's the vocalist?
The vocalist is Amy Petrangeli, an old friend of mine from my days at the University of Michigan, but she's also an alumna of Central Michigan University, so this is a bit of a homecoming for her. She's an absolutely fabulous soprano, and I remember the moment that Kevin called me up about a year ago to say, hey, you know, Amy's interested in working with us. What do you think? And I thought to myself, I mean, there's no other answer but yes here. She is such a consummate musician and an incredible vocalist, and it's just been a huge pleasure to write for her voice.
The concert featuring Evan Ware's The Quietest of Whispers and Symphony No. 2 will be performed at the Staples Family Concert Hall at Central Michigan University on Sunday. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Lester. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, too.
Support for arts and cultural coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, our Friday political commentators discuss Governor Whitmer's call for state PFAS standards.
Michigan needs to get aggressive and move ahead. I applaud the governor for taking this action.
That's in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Law enforcement roadside drug tests have had a reputation for being notoriously inaccurate. But the Michigan State Police believe they've been testing a device which is much more accurate. It's finished a year-long pilot test in counties around the state. Now it plans a second round of testing, and it, or a similar device, could be used statewide. The device we're talking about is Abbott Laboratories' Alere DDS2 mobile test. It's been researched by a Kansas lab. Dr. Timothy Roerig is the director of the Sedgwick County Regional Forensic Science Center. He and his team conducted a peer review study of the DDS2. Dr. Roerig joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, sir.
So let's start with the obvious question. How accurate is this on detecting drugs and people pulled over for something?
Well, the device is accurate as far as a screening device to detect drugs or drug classes that the instrument is designed for. I mean, there are some drugs out there that the instrument is not designed to pick up. You can't be 100% inclusive of all drugs out there that could potentially impair driving.
Right. I saw the list was for things like opiates, cocaine, amphetamines, or methamphetamines. How well does it test for marijuana?
Cannabis, at least in our hands, it was a great screening device. We saw a good correlation not only with oral fluid that was collected, analyzed by the laboratory, but we also compared it to blood samples. And one unique thing about our study is we also compared it to the results or opinion of a drug recognition expert. These are police officers that are trained in identifying impairment and taking their observations and at least categorizing it into a class of drugs.
This thing is better at testing for some drugs than others. How much should law enforcement rely on the DDS2 for drugs such as, well, I mentioned amphetamine and methamphetamine? They have a much lower accuracy rate.
Well, it's a good device because the alternative is we don't have one for drugs like we do for alcohol, where there's a presumptive roadside test. With drugs, there is no tool. So it's another tool that law enforcement can use at least to have probable cause to go further in their investigation of drug-impaired driving.
So this is a screening device, not necessarily proof of intoxication or drug influence. Is that correct?
That is correct. It gives you a presumptive result that says we believe with a high level of probability, but we believe a drug or this class of drugs is present in your oral fluid. You should go on to confirm either with more sophisticated laboratory analysis in the oral fluid, or what a lot of people are looking at is using that result as a probable cause to either draw a blood sample or get a search warrant for a blood sample to be collected, which is a more invasive procedure.
But these results wouldn't be something you want to take to court.
I believe right now, just based upon this presumptive test, no, you would not. I don't think it would fly in any court if it was just an immunoassay test result only.
Let's talk about some of the concerns. If this device is not 100% accurate, a false positive could land someone in jail overnight or used for probable cause for a warrant to search a vehicle that otherwise wouldn't have been searched. How concerned are law enforcement agencies about those kinds of scenarios?
Well, I can't speak for what other law enforcement agencies or a law enforcement agency has, but again, it's a tool. It's a presumptive test. There are going to be some instances where you may get a positive reading when, in fact, when confirmation is done, you get a not detected. But we have the same challenges, for instance, with our field test for drugs, that is, powders and pills that are found out in the field. Law enforcement will use a color test to say, well, we believe it may be cocaine, and that's enough to go on to further investigate.
So let's talk about the procedure. You mentioned oral fluids. I'll just call it spit. If you're pulled over and the officer wants to test you, what exactly is the procedure?
Depending upon the statutes in the state that it's occurring in, but at least the mechanism of collection is essentially a lollipop-type device is handed to the suspect. They place it in their mouth. It's in the mouth for a prescribed period of time. There's different collection devices if we're talking in general, but it's a matter of just a couple minutes. That device will absorb the oral fluid from the mouth, and then that device is put into the DDS2, or there's other manufacturers as well, for an immunoassay test, which is a very common screening test that's used in laboratories throughout the world, and it will give you a presumptive positive or negative at a proscribed cutoff concentration.
Some defense attorneys are skeptical. One attorney in an article in the Port Huron Times Herald called it junk science. How well has this worked in the field? You've done the lab test, but in the field, in different states, is it proven technology?
Well, there's a number of studies that have been published. Others are just not published but are known within the scientific community that it is a good screening device. Immunoassay testing has been vetted for decades. I mean, it's a very common test to look for drugs, look for other biological markers used in hospitals, again, throughout the world. Oral fluid testing is not new. It's not novel. You can go back in the literature back into the 70s, and researchers have been looking at the use of oral fluid for drug testing. The challenge is that the concentration of the drugs are quite low in the oral fluid, and until new technology has emerged as a common tool within forensic laboratories, we really didn't have the sensitivity to detect these drugs. And that's why you saw kind of a hiatus, if you will, of oral fluid testing, especially for law enforcement purposes. With that said, oral fluid testing, for instance, in the insurance industry has been used for many, many years. So one, it's not new and novel. It's been well vetted. So I would take issue with the fact that it's junk science. Now, with that said, where some people try to make the leap, which is problematic, is that they'll try to take an oral fluid concentration and directly say, well, that is equivalent to a blood concentration. That you really can't do. But as a tool to say, yes, this person has drug on board that is proximal to the time of the contact with law enforcement, that could be an explanation for their impaired driving behavior. It's a very reliable, fantastic tool, and one that I believe should be used.
How many other states are using this DDS2 mobile test?
Well, I know that a number of states are looking at it. Alabama has just rolled it out. State of Kansas, we're looking at using it here, but as earlier when you said you want to call it spit versus oral fluid, the statutes in the state of Kansas to allow collection allowed the collection of saliva, and oral fluid is mainly saliva, but there's some other things in there, and that's why it's called oral fluid. So the legislature wanted to clean up our statutes before we started using this or potentially using this as a presumptive test for drug-impaired driving. California, there's been a number of counties in California that have been looking at it and have used it at some level. And the Michigan State Police just completed a very nice pilot study that kind of, you know, goes along with our findings and goes along with findings that other researchers have found throughout the country. It's quite frequently used in other countries in the world, Australia, the UK, some European countries have used similar devices in their enforcement of traffic law.
Dr. Timothy Roerig is the director of the Sedgwick County Regional Forensic Science Center in Kansas. Thanks very much for telling us about the DDS-2.
You're welcome, sir.
Now, in a related bit of news, my Michigan Radio News colleague Virginia Gordon reports a state-appointed commission is advising against setting a legal limit for the level of THC for marijuana in driver blood tests. Available science shows a poor correlation between THC blood levels and driver impairment. It recommends using roadside sobriety tests instead. This week, Governor Gretchen Whitmer instructed the Department of Environmental Quality to start working on determining a safe drinking water level for PFAS, the polyfluoroalkyl or perfluoroalkyl chemicals, polluting water in spots around the state. These chemicals have been associated with cancer and other health risks. Environmental groups applauded the move. The chemical industry says Michigan ought to let the U.S. EPA determine what's safe. Joining us to discuss those findings are our Friday political commentators, Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican Majority Leader in the Michigan State Senate, and Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic member of the state legislature. So, Ken, states such as New Jersey and New Hampshire have set what's called a maximum contaminant level for PFAS chemicals. In fact, New Hampshire looked at 4 of the PFAS chemicals that have been found in water sources instead of the 2 that Michigan's looked at so far. The U.S. EPA's health advisory only looked at those 2. Should Michigan set its own PFAS restrictions or wait for the federal government?
Oh, I think absolutely Michigan needs to proceed full steam ahead on setting a drinking water standard for these chemicals. The federal EPA, I think, has just been dilatory. They haven't really done much. They have what they call an advisory threshold, but that doesn't really mean anything. And, you know, when you have issues that affect human health and the environment, and in this case, chemical contamination of drinking water, Michigan needs to get aggressive and move ahead. I applaud the governor for taking this action.
Vicki, is Governor Whitmer correct in ordering a determination on what is safe for PFAS chemicals in water?
Absolutely. That was one of the key issues in the Michigan election. People are very concerned about contaminants in their drinking water, and it's lead, it's mercury, it's PFAS, it's a whole host of chemicals, sewage, prescription drugs that get in our water system. And I think it's time that Michigan sets standards. The current standards are only recommended standards and not enforceable standards by the EPA, and they're not strong enough, nor are they guaranteed to help.
I'm curious, Governor Rick Snyder signed into law a measure that bans state agencies from creating new regulations stricter than federal government unless there's clear and convincing need due to exceptional circumstances. Ken, does PFAS contamination meet those requirements?
At some point, this might come into play. If the EPA ever does determine a maximum contaminant level for these PFAS chemicals, and let's just say, for example, hypothetically, let's say Michigan sets a standard of 35 parts per trillion, and let's say the EPA comes out with one of 50 parts or 70 parts, then you have an issue. But at this point, there's not an issue because the EPA hasn't set a standard. They only have an advisory threshold. But this issue of whether Michigan should or could establish stricter standards might come into play down the road on this issue.
Vicki, how do you determine clear and convincing need? I mean, after all, the US EPA says it's starting to look at the standards for PFAS in drinking water.
We can't wait for the federal government to act on this. They're moving way too slowly, and they haven't taken any action. So it's up to the states now to be the inventive marketplaces of protecting the health, safety, and welfare of its citizens that it needs to be. And I think that Michigan is on the right track right now. And I'm heartened to see that there's bipartisan support for this issue. The toxic waste sites for PFAS currently are in a lot of Republican and rural areas and areas of the state where there was a lot of firefighter training. I'm very glad to see that Republicans and Democrats are coming together, and we'll just see what they settle on as the standard. But right now, there is no enforceable federal standard or federal law to protect safe drinking water from these chemicals, and Michigan needs to be a leader. And because we also, the central actors in the Great Lakes water region, which is home to 20% of the world's surface freshwater, we also need to be stewards of the environment for everyone and really lead the way on this critical issue.
I'm not a chemist. I'm assuming that neither of you have a chemistry background. Is that correct?
Correct.
That's correct.
Okay. So earlier this year, the state of Pennsylvania started a process for setting limits on two of these 4,000 or so PFAS chemicals, the most common ones, PFOS and PFOA. However, New Hampshire looked at four of them, and all four of those chemicals have been found in water sources in Michigan. So should Michigan look at setting limits for just those two PFAS chemicals that the EPA advisory is about, that Pennsylvania is looking at, or expand the list to include those other PFAS chemicals that have been found in Michigan drinking water sources and are being regulated by New Hampshire?
You know, I'm not an expert in this, but, you know, Michigan should be aggressive in protecting drinking water and the environment. And if that means looking at more than two or three or four iterations of these chemicals, then so be it. They should move ahead. I actually wanted to comment on this no stricter than federal issue. I think Governor Snyder made a mistake in signing that bill. It's hard for me as a Republican to understand this position, which goes against historical Republican philosophy that we ought to just defer to the federal government. This might at some point be a prime example of why I thought it was a bad idea to have that bill passed and signed into law.
Vicki, what about how many chemicals should we be looking for? Two, four, thousands?
There's probably more than four, I would say. These chemicals are in Teflon and other coatings. The manufacturers are being sued across the country for not recognizing their responsibility. A suit was settled in Minnesota with 3M, a major manufacturer of these chemicals. There are a lot of chemicals, and in order to say that our drinking water is safe, we need to begin to take action. Starting with PFAS is a great way to go, and I think that the current standard recommended by Winnie Brinks, state senator from the Grand Rapids area, at 5 parts per trillion, is a good starting point. We'll probably end up a little higher. With regard to the law that the governor signed, no stricter than the federal standards, he had been a strong supporter of the environment and had vetoed that very law. So his action in lame duck session in 2018 was very surprising indeed, and it was kind of like him burning his bridges behind him in terms of his legacy on at least trying to take control of environmental policy. It was very disappointing.
We've got only less than a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about a different topic. Attorney General Dana Nessel issued an opinion that the lame duck maneuver to establish an entity to oversee building a tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac where the pipelines that make up Enbridge Line 5 was unconstitutional. Ken, what'd you think of that?
Well, I mean, she opined that it's unconstitutional based on what I would call a legal technicality, but I'm not dismissing it. It wasn't on the substantive issue of should you build a tunnel and put Line 5 in it. I think the issue is, well, what happens next? I mean, if that law is unconstitutional, and if her opinion is sustained by the courts, then you still have this remaining question of what do you do with Line 5?
Vicki, what do you think of the move by the Attorney General?
I support her move. I think that the tunnel is a terrible idea. It does not solve the problem. You still could have a pipe burst underground in the Straits of Mackinac, contaminating all of the Great Lakes. This was a technicality, but the maneuver by the legislature to transfer the authority over this to the Mackinac Straits Authority, even that organization did not want to take control of this pipeline underground.
And we have to note that Enbridge is a corporate underwriter of this radio station. Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Kent Sikkema, a former Republican legislator. You can hear their analyses of the big political stories of the week most Fridays right here on Stateside. Hey, thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock, who we keep in a little room in the back until we need him. It's true. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.